This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So this week we lost a remarkable American statesman.
Politician, diplomat, four-star general Colin Powell has died of COVID-related complications.
He was 84 years old.
Powell served in multiple Republican administrations, shaping American foreign policy.
That's one of those passings that feels kind of like the loss of a family member. General Powell has been a part of public life for all of mine, basically, and maybe yours. In many ways, he felt like a familiar figure.
Colin Powell was many things to many people, a symbol of the American dream, the public voice, for a time, of the Iraq War, a so-called rhino, or Republican in name only, a good soldier. Though widely remembered as a barrier-breaking hero by folks across the aisle, in his death, as in his life, there are those who use Colin Powell as an opportunity for scoring political points.
Like almost everyone his age, Colin Powell was fully vaccinated against COVID. And yet, according to his family and doctors, Colin Powell died of COVID. Of course, that fact does not make his death any less sad, nor is it unusual. Many thousands of vaccinated Americans have died of COVID. So what does that tell you exactly? Well, it tells you you've been lied to.
Tucker Carlson conveniently omits the important fact that Colin Powell has been sick for years with multiple myeloma, a rare blood cancer. Looking back at the life of Colin Powell, it's worth recalling that he was looked upon with favor among 85% of Americans, according to a 2001 Gallup poll.
Colin Powell rose up in the 90s to prominence at a time when we really needed some black heroes.
Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page.
The man seems almost too good to be true, but we want him to be true. And he is a guy who fits the role. He has an unblemished record, wonderful family life, worked his way up, immigrant family. I mean, you name it. He's an iconic figure, larger than life. I mean, people tell me whether they like Powell's politics or not, they just can't get enough of him.
I interviewed Clarence Page for a segment we did on Colin Powell back in 2004. At the time, he'd just gone on NBC's Meet the Press and admitted that the evidence for Saddam Hussein's possession of weapons of mass destruction just wasn't there.
Turned out that the sourcing was inaccurate and wrong, and in some cases, deliberately misleading.
A little over a year earlier, Powell had been tasked by the Bush administration with presenting the evidence against Saddam Hussein to the UN Security Council.
What you will see is an accumulation of facts and disturbing patterns of behavior. The facts and Iraq's behavior demonstrate that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community. Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
Fred Kaplan, a veteran reporter on foreign policy and national security and longtime writer of Slate's War Stories column, had long acquaintance with Powell as a figure and a policymaker, and he joins me now in my home office, which is about a dozen yards from his home office, since we're married. So why don't you start by telling me how you felt when you read that Colin Powell had died?
Well, I mean, I guess like a lot of people, surprised. I didn't know that he had myeloma cancer. I guess that's really what caused his death, that plus COVID.
Take your time. This show, you may not know, is heavily edited. So.
I do know. Where do you want me to go with this?
I want to know how you personally felt.
Well, I mean, I knew him a bit. I wouldn't say we were friends. I interviewed him several times. So he was a complicated figure in public life.
You had a correspondence.
We had a correspondence. You know, there are a few four-star generals that I've known who, when I write something critical of them, they've written or called me to complain about it. But they say, well, Powell said in his letter something like, you must have been on a tight deadline because this isn't as convincing as some of your criticisms of me, which you know, it's a very seductive thing. It's saying, oh, he's criticizing me, but oh, he's read other things that I've written too. So it's a backhanded compliment. It's a fairly transparent way of getting you to come over to his side. And somebody did that to me when I was much younger and more naive about this sort of thing. So I was kind of amused that Powell, who was very politically adroit, would be pulling this maneuver.
I think it's clear that there's no end to the vanity of journalists, so I'm sure he guessed right more often than not. You admired him.
I admired him to some degree, but then, of course, there was his fatal act.
Let's talk about the way he grew up.
You know, he was the son of Jamaican immigrants, was born in Harlem, worked his way up. In his high school, he worked for some, I think, a baby furniture store owned by some Jewish guys in the Bronx and learned Yiddish fairly fluently, I think, actually. In fact, it's kind of funny. When he met Yitzhak Rabin, he goes up and starts speaking Yiddish to him and is surprised that Rabin doesn't speak Yiddish. But for a leading Israeli Jew, I mean, they want to leave the ghetto behind, and Yiddish is certainly part of the ghetto, so he wouldn't have known Yiddish. But he rises through the ranks. He goes into the army, rises through the ranks. You know, he was a grunt in Vietnam. You know, he was just an enlisted man, a soldier in the rice paddies. He becomes a corps commander in Europe. He becomes Reagan's national security advisor, then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And all through this, I mean, I knew him a little bit from the time he was national security advisor, retaining a fairly quote-unquote normal disposition. You know, you could talk to him, or he would talk to you the way a real person would talk to you, not some stuffy general. When he was national security advisor, I was a reporter for the Boston Globe. I was a defense reporter for the Boston Globe. And he went and gave a talk to a bunch of grade school kids in a very black part of Washington, D.C. It was kind of inspiring. I mean, he was introduced by, you know, five or six Board of Education people, a few of whom kept referring to him as a lieutenant colonel, and in fact, he was a lieutenant general. Anyway, so then he gets up and he says to the kids, okay, some people say I was a lieutenant colonel. I'm a lieutenant general. Generals give orders. Now, come on down here closer to the stage so I can talk to you. And then he starts, now, I work in the White House. You've probably seen that. When you go by the White House, the part that's in the west part of the building, I'm in that part of the building. How did I get there? I grew up in a neighborhood very similar to yours. But then I learned, you have to learn how to speak properly. You have to read. You have to really study. It's really giving them a... You know, I was very impressed, and I said, God, this guy could really go someplace. And, you know, I wasn't surprised when at some point, briefly, he considered running for president. You know, in, I think, 1996, he was a Republican. He probably wouldn't have made it through even then the Republican Party primary. He was too liberal for the Republicans even then. But I also remember seeing him speak at some Republican convention, and I forget if it was 96 or 2000. But anyway, I remember thinking, well, you know, if I really thought this guy represented what Republicans stand for, I could see voting for a Republican now and then.
Why didn't he run for president?
Well, I mean, the story I heard, and this has been acknowledged as part of the reason, is that his wife was terrified that some racist would assassinate him. You know, and just said, you are not going to run for president. He was very insistent about it. You know, she might have been right.
Okay, so there's a moment he said would basically be a blot on his record forever. He said it was painful. Talk about the run-up to and the impact of his presentation on weapons of mass destruction at the United Nations.
All right. Well, let's set the context a little first. So George W. Bush names him as Secretary of State. a decision that is met with universal acclaim everywhere, internationally, among Democrats here, a thing that just hitting it out of the ballpark.
He was far more popular, according to the polls, than Bush was.
Oh, yeah. Bush came into office with no experience in foreign policy. Cheney and Rumsfeld had their own blots from previous associations with Nixon and so forth. So Powell is like an unimpeachable guy, Secretary of State, and he comes in. He has so much confidence. He's speaking with just an Eric. He thinks he's going to be running the show. And then...
At least his show.
Yeah, foreign policy. He's going to be the man on foreign policy. And since Bush really doesn't know very much about foreign policy, the U.S. voice in the world is going to be his voice. He's thinking this. Then, almost from day one, he discovers himself being outmaneuvered by the tag team of Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who had very different ideas about the world than he did and who had been tag teaming since the Nixon administration. So he's sidelined.
Give me examples.
Well, almost the first thing that he says is that, yeah, we will be resuming President Clinton's nuclear negotiations with North Korea, which had actually made some progress, but the Clinton administration ended, and it was still kind of in flux. Okay, well, Condi Rice, National Security Advisor, calls him up and says, we are going to be doing no such thing. You have to backpedal on this in public. And he called a press conference, said, well, I got a little ahead of my skis. He had basically eat shit. He had to take it back. So that was step number one. Then anything to do with arms control, Cheney installed as Powell's Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, John Bolton, whose main job was to report back to Cheney everything that Powell was doing on arms control and to try to sideline it or sabotage it in one way or another. Every time there was a National Security Council meeting, Powell maybe won the argument, Cheney would go into Bush's office afterwards and get it reversed. You know, one of the first things the Bush administration did was to abrogate the anti-ballistic missile treaty. Powell very much argued against doing that, but he lost. He kept losing. There was an interesting side effect, and so this has been overlooked in a lot of coverage about him. On issues where Cheney and Rumsfeld really didn't care, Powell actually exerted a tremendous amount of influence. For example, in the fall of 2001, India and Pakistan were really set to go to war with each other. And Powell did some shuttle diplomacy and really calmed it down. He prevented war between India and Pakistan. And Cheney and Rumsfeld led him because they didn't really care. Also on China, when China shot down a U.S. spy plane, there are tremendous tensions rising between U.S. and China. This was at a time when there really were no tensions. And he went over there and not only calmed that situation down, but articulated a very pragmatic policy toward China. And again, you know, Rumsfeld and Cheney, they were focused on Russia and North Korea and Iran and Iraq. And so they didn't care about that. So when he was given a free hand, he actually showed what maybe he could have done on other areas where he wasn't given a free hand. So the Iraq War is gearing up. It's clear that it's going to be happening. Powell is against it. He articulates to Bush the pottery barn rule. You know, you break it, you own it. In other words, we go to war with Iraq, it's going to shatter into a million pieces, and you're responsible for all of it. To no avail. He's the one guy in the administration against it. So he does force Bush to take the issue to the UN, which Cheney did not want to do. Cheney, not a big fan of international law and things like this. And you know, there's quite a lot of opposition or at least skepticism about this war effort, internationally and domestically too. And so Cheney comes up with a diabolical idea. Let's have Cullen make the case for invasion to the UN Security Council. Because if Powell could make a case, a lot of the reason why it would work, if it did work, is because Powell was making the case. They'd say, well, Cullen's not making up stuff. Yeah, this is real stuff. So Powell was handed a script, and he said, no, this is nonsense. I'm not going to read this. This is crap. So he goes to CIA headquarters, camps out there for days, going over everything. crossing out stuff that he doesn't think is valid and leaving in stuff that he thought was valid, and goes to the UN Security Council and made to many people what seemed like a plausible case for an invasion. Now, what we didn't know until later was that almost everything he said was not true.
Did he know that?
Let's see that. No, I don't think he did. He was bamboozled. The book by Robert Draper, To Start a War, which was a very good book on the origins of our involvement in Iraq, notes that there were people in the CIA who could have told Powell that all the claims that were in the document that he was reading from were either false or at least dubious, or at least that there was another opinion about it. This was not a unanimous or even consensus opinion, but they were deliberately left out of the room. George Tenet, CIA director, had this view, which is accurate, that basically the CIA works for one customer, the President of the United States. And if the President doesn't trust you or doesn't listen to what you're saying, you might as well not even be in business.
Can we recall that the CIA was suspect enough for Cheney and Rumsfeld to create their own private intelligence service?
No, that's true. Initially, the CIA was reluctant. Cheney would say, look, I think that Iraq has links to Osama bin Laden, or Iraq is developing weapons of mass destruction. They would look at it and say, I don't see that here. So Rumsfeld created his own kind of intelligence unit inside the Pentagon. And then there was another one in the White House. And basically, they just came up with the most frightening scenarios possible. And it was fine if it just seemed plausible. They weren't looking for truth. They were looking for
narratives, as we like to say on this show.
So George Tenet was determined to tell George Bush what George Bush wanted to hear, which was that, yeah, there are ties to Al-Qaeda and he's developing weapons of mass destruction. There were CIA analysts who could have told Powell, well, there's only about a 30% chance that what we're saying here is true. But they were not allowed into the room. So Powell didn't even know that these opinions, and in some cases they were minority opinions, which emerged as correct, but he didn't know that they even existed. So he was finagled into this position by Cheney and then bamboozled. Now, something against Powell, though, here. One of the minority views on a lot of these issues, which turned out to be right, were held by the State Department's own intelligence unit, the Intelligence and Research Bureau. He did not rely on them. I don't think he even consulted them much.
His own division?
Yeah. So that's on him. That's on him.
So he gave this speech, and the substance of it was what, and what was the impact?
Well, yeah, there were a few parts of it. He showed drawings of what he called a mobile biological weapons vehicle.
Here we see cargo vehicles are again at this transshipment point, and we can see that they are accompanied by a decontamination vehicle associated with biological or chemical weapons activity.
Which, you know, could be seen roaming around in Iraq, which apparently, you know, built biological weapons. He held up the vial of what substance they were supposedly making.
Ladies and gentlemen, these are sophisticated facilities. For example, they can produce anthrax and botulinum toxin. In fact, they can produce enough dry biological agent in a single month to kill thousands upon thousands of people. And dry agent of this type is the most lethal form for human beings.
And then he had a very interesting, he played a tape of two Iraqi officers talking with each other the day before UN inspectors were going to come visit a suspected chemical weapons storage site. And what the officers were saying, one would say, now, did we clean up that site? And he goes, yeah, it's all clean. And Powell said from this, and it seemed like a reasonable inference, that this proves they knew that we were coming to inspect it. They cleaned it out ahead of time. And so they're deceiving us, and there could be things like this all over Iraq. And, you know, even we didn't discover it until well after the war. You know, after the war, the CIA interviewed a lot of Iraqi officers. And they found one of the guys who was on that phone conversation. And what turned out to be the case was that this was a chemical weapons site that had been decontaminated after the 1990 Gulf War, 91 Gulf War, by the disarmament arrangements that ended that war. So what this was, they wanted to make sure before the inspectors came that back when they decontaminated this place in 1991, that they didn't leave anything behind, that it really was clean. So they didn't want to be falsely accused that they were violating any agreement now. So they weren't clearing the place out days ahead of time. They were confirming that it had been cleared out more than a decade ago. Completely different interpretation of what happened.
He changed a lot of minds. He changed her mind.
Well, yeah, a lot of people who had been skeptical, it served its purpose. They said, well, you know, this is making a pretty good case. I have to admit, for about 2 weeks, I was among those people. I had written columns in Slate, kind of skeptical of the case for war. And then after that presentation, I wrote about two columns, which really I was kind of gung-ho on invading. And I cited Powell as the main reason for this happening. Let me just interrupt and say, about 2 weeks later, still a couple weeks before the invasion, I changed my mind. I was learning things that a lot of what was in the speech was not true or didn't make sense. And even if it did, it wasn't really a rationale to go to war. So I changed my mind back.
You also thought the government wasn't.
There were some statements made by Bush. He was told by somebody, well, you know, after the war, we're going to have to do something to make peace between the Shiites and the Sunnis. And he was like, what? And so I said, I wrote a column saying, oh, Christ, you know, if there's a war, there's going to be a civil war afterwards. There's going to be insurgency. We don't have any means to settle this. We're getting into a huge imbroglio.
We're not going to be able to fix what we broke. The pottery barn.
We're going to make it worse. We're going to go in there with a hammer. So yeah, Powell did have an impact on some people, including some in the UN, which was what it was aimed at. And, you know, it was way later that he learned that he had been bamboozled. But here's where we get into the tragic part of Colin Powell. Because, yeah, okay, he was bamboozled. And first, you know, he'd been around. He should have taken these things with a little more grains of salt. But ultimately, he was a good soldier. He was looking for ways to be a team player. And this was the way. By the end of Bush's first term, he leaves office because he realizes he's lost all power within the administration. And even outside of the administration, you know, his counterparts in Europe, they liked him, they respected him, but, you know, he would come over and he would say things and they would realize, well, that's Colin and I like Colin and I agree with him, but I don't get any feeling that he's representing the president of the United States and that's what I'm interested in. And so, you know, Bush would start sending over Condi Rice or even Jim Baker, his father's secretary of state, because then people would say, okay, well, this is, in effect, the president of the United States talking. Powell didn't have that position anymore, so he left. And then the thing I have a problem with him, and a lot of people do, is that he didn't say anything after that for several years. And, you know, the run-up to the invasion, even given his UN speech, privately, he was still opposed to invasion. He personally did not see any of this as grounds for invasion. If he had resigned in protest, which granted very few U.S. officials, much less four-star generals, do. He wasn't a four-star general then. He was Secretary of State, but he still saw himself as a general. Anyway, if he had resigned in protest, that would have had a tremendous impact in the United States and among allies who were still kind of wavering on whether or not to go along with Bush in this war. He could have stopped the war. If he had said something after leaving office, you know, the war was still raging. This was 2004. I think it could have had an impact on Congress, on some allies, on the state of the war. He was asked by Robert Draper, again, the author of this book, to start a war. Why didn't he do it? And he goes, well, look, what choice did I have? He was the president of the United States. And see, that's the view of a general who has been inculcated with the view of civilian authority. You should pay attention to civilian authority. You should carry out all lawful orders.
It's the view of a good soldier.
It's a good view of a good soldier. And you know, usually we should be happy about that. We don't want generals going around making policy. They're not the policymakers. However, there is a flip side to this military ethos, which is branded into every officer from the time he's a cadet, and that is you carry out the order or you resign. That's a legitimate option. You're not being a turncoat or a traitor by resigning. Some have resigned. Not very many, though. Not very many. Officers are so steeped in the ethos of civil authority. We don't want coups. We don't want MacArthurs. That they don't pay attention to the flip side of this. It was that, well, there is a way out. I can just leave. And that would have had a tremendous impact. And he didn't do it. I wrote a story in 2006 for the LA Times called Colin Powell Nowhere Man, because he had kind of disappeared. And the few public things that he went on, he was on the Jon Stewart show once. And Stewart, of course, had been very critical of the Iraq War. He didn't push Powell on this heavily, but he asked questions that gave Powell an opening to go down that road. Because, I mean, by this time, Bob Woodward's book, Plan of Attack, had come out, in which Powell, who clearly was a major source, was thinking or saying that the war was really a bad idea, that Cheney had the fever for war. So he was saying these things privately. He was saying the things on background. But he just didn't go there at all. He would say, well, you know, there are disagreements in every administration. The president makes the decision. He's a great guy. He and Laura were over at the house just last week for dinner. So, again, I would be less critical if he had just said nothing to anybody. But it was known that he was saying these things privately or on background. And when it came to the point where he could have actually had an impact on life, I mean, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives, he didn't take that step. And I understand why he didn't take that step. He was not that kind of guy. And most military officers, for better or for worse, and by the way, usually for better, are not that kind of guy. But this was a moment when he could have played a truly historic role, and he backed away from it.
At the end of your column, you said he had a marvelous life. But
I think I said he had a wonderful life.
He had a wonderful life.
Like Jimmy Stewart, yeah.
But it fell short of a decisive one.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, look, he accomplished a great deal. I've talked with people who've worked for him, and they always said it was fun to work for him. He paid attention to the people working for him. He would listen to subordinates. He would make them feel like they were part of his team. In retirement, he collected cars and worked on their engine. And then after he left office, he did a lot of charity work. He founded a public policy institute at City College of New York, which was his alma mater.
He worked with children at risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another thing is, you know, there's some people in positions like his who are black who say, well, you know, I happen to be black. I would prefer to be treated as a general, not a black. No, he was the exact opposite. He says, people say that, you know, I'm the first black chairman of the Joint Chiefs or the first black secretary of state. And yes, I want to play up that fact. I'm proud of that fact. I want it to be noted. You know, at one point when Jesse Jackson was running for president, Powell was in an administration. Jackson called Colin Powell for advice on defense issues, and he answered the questions. And I remember Powell was once on, you know, Face the Nation or something like that. And somebody said, now, Jesse Jackson thinks such and such about defense. Do you agree with that? And Powell said, you're trying to get me to criticize him, and I'm not going to do that. He endorsed Obama in the 2008 election over John McCain, who was an old friend of his. I mean, it really pissed off McCain. There were some reasons not having to do with Obama that Powell didn't endorse McCain. But then he endorsed Obama again, and in fact has endorsed nothing but Democratic presidential candidates since, though he never quite became a Democrat. Though he, especially when Trump came to identify the Republican Party, he moved away from it pretty drastically. And I see now that Trump put out a statement, really disgusting, you know, calling, oh, well, he caused the Iraq War and he's just a rhino and but a rest in peace, I guess, you know, something like that. But so, yeah, that's why I said he had a wonderful life. But there was one moment when he could have had a decisive life. And he didn't go there.
What, in your definition, determines a decisive life?
Well, if you're someone in his position, I mean, Secretary of State is number three in presidential succession. So you're within whispering range of the President of the United States, the top officer in the United States military.
And then top officer in foreign policy.
Well, top diplomat, top officer. So, you know, decisive means you're in a position to cause a pivot in the annals of war and peace. And he was there. He was in that position to do that. There was a moment, really not very many people in that position have that opportunity. And he did, and he didn't swing at it.
Thank you very much, Fred.
Sure, thank you.
Fred Kaplan is the author of The Bomb, Dark Territory, The Insurgents, 1959, Daydream Believer, The Wizards of Armageddon, writer of Slate's War Stories column since 2002, and husband to me since 1983. Join us for the big show this week. It's posted usually on Friday around dinner time. And if you haven't done it yet, you should sign up for our very cool weekly newsletter. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.